scientist who's been doing work on proteins, specifically enzymes. I'll talk a little bit more about them in a few minutes. And became a Christian right before a few years before I entered my undergraduate studies at UC Berkeley, a fine Christian school on the West Coast. And found this clash of worldviews, as you might expect, my newly formed Christian worldview and the worldview that was coming across in lectures at UC Berkeley. I was not rattled by it, but I was bothered by the fact that the authority of the lectern, the authority of the professorship, can be used to undermine faith and to somewhat subtly, but it comes over and over and over again in your courses, convey another worldview, which I came, it's not called, they're not saying, hey, we're teaching you materialism, we're teaching you naturalism, but it's the idea that the periodic table is everything, that the laws of physics and chemistry govern everything, and that our thoughts, our consciousness, our beliefs, our religious convictions all flow from the periodic table. And it seems somewhat ludicrous when you think about that, but that's the view that is being espoused in the sciences. And I didn't push back against it. I didn't do a raise my hand in a large lecture and challenge the professor kind of thing from God's Not Dead. I was smart enough to remain quiet, but I had this growing conviction in me that this abuse of authority that you see in the academy then and now, and it's only growing, needs to be addressed and needs to be answered. And so I started thinking about how my career might go in the direction of addressing that. And doors opened, and as long as the doors opened, I kept going. And there was a point where it felt like I couldn't keep going, that I lost my job in Cambridge because of the controversy over intelligent design. But another door opened, and I kept going. And so that's kind of how I got to where I am. 25 years or so of technical research on genes and enzymes and proteins, and don't worry if none of that makes any sense to you. This will be the cookies on the bottom shelf. I'll explain everything very clearly. I got an opportunity to write a book, and I realized what I don't want to do is simply take technical work and distill it down and try to make it, try to give a layman's explanation of technical work. Although I do a little bit of that in my book, I felt as though it's more important to demonstrate that fundamentally the argument, the debate over where we came from is not technical. It does not live up here in the academic sphere. It lives right down here on the street. It's a common sense argument. And I felt as though if I can, in the book, convey that this is a common sense argument, it's not a technical argument, then I undermine the to-ing and fro-ing that otherwise happens. Because otherwise, if I say, here's the work I did on proteins can't evolve, then someone else who works on proteins will say, Axe didn't tell you about this, or Axe didn't tell you about that. And it goes back and forth. And the people who think, hope I'm right, they come and say, did you hear what so-and-so said? And then I have to answer that. And I do some of this. I do quite a bit of this. But it really goes nowhere as long as we're upholding the notion, and it's a false notion, I think, that this is fundamentally a technical debate. I think it's fundamentally not technical. It's fundamentally common sense. And by the way, when am I supposed to be finished? Do I have an hour or two? An hour. Okay. So, Undeniable is all about taking it down to the common sense level. And I want to show you, to start with, the power of ordinary common sense reasoning, which I actually think the most potent arguments are the simplest, most commonsensical arguments. And the more complicated and layered your argument is, the more dubious it is. And that's a good thing, right? So let's take this, maybe the first and foremost of all philosophical questions, the question of existence. What is the nature of existence? This has been asked by philosophers from the beginning of philosophy. What is the nature of existence? And this was one of the great Greek philosophers. You may not have heard of him, Gorgias, who devoted his life to this question of existence, pondering what it means, how we can know about existence, coming up with his own ideas about existence. And after a lifetime of thinking about existence, he came to this conclusion. Okay, now, I think we can say he was probably a very smart man. All these Greek philosophers were very smart people. And yet, we can also say he may have been smarter than anyone in this room, okay? But We can also say that's wrong. We're comfortable saying that's wrong. I don't see anyone in here worrying about whether they exist. Oh, no, a smart guy said nothing exists. That means I don't exist. We know that's wrong, and it's not just that he thought these thoughts a long time ago. If someone today were to take up, say a physicist were to take up where he left off and develop a complex theory of physics and put down the chalk at the end and say, therefore, nothing exists and you don't exist. We would know that the physicist would be wrong, right? And it's not, we wouldn't have to say, oh, in step 15 here, we wouldn't have to analyze this. We'd say, I don't need to follow the details, but I just know you came to the wrong conclusion. There's something like that happening, I think, with Origins, where there's just a commonsensical way to say that we cannot be accidents. And it doesn't matter how complicated you make the claim that we are accidents. If you come back to this simple claim, the simple commonsensical claim, I think you have a very strong refutation of the alternative. So, as I had started actually on the book, and I came across this quote from a UC Berkeley psychology professor named Allison Govnik. She wrote, "By elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them, even children brought up as atheists." So, and this is, people are studying this, and they realize, regardless of your upbringing, by age 4, if you see a butterfly, you think of that as something that was made by a godlike designer, because you look at it, you see the complexity and the beauty, and what else are you going to think? It's interesting, you don't have to be taught. It's not that your parents said, oh, that's a butterfly, God made butterflies. You could have been brought up in an atheist home, and you still see this. Now, of course, Allison Govnik, she wrote that. That was written, by the way, in the Wall Street Journal, in this article titled, "See Jane Evolve, Picture Books Explain Darwin." Govnik is not at all saying that it's a good thing that we have this intuition. I call it the universal design intuition. She sees it as a challenge for education, and we need to start early and earlier teaching very young kids with picture books. No, you think the butterfly was made by a godlike designer, but actually Charles Darwin explained where butterflies and dogs and people came from. So you have to start suppressing that intuition at an early age. It's interesting, though, that it never fully works, does it? Francis Crick, near the end of his life, wrote that biologists must constantly keep in mind that the things they study were not designed, but rather evolved. So even after decades and decades of telling himself that no, evolution is true, he has to keep pushing down this intuition because it keeps coming up. All right, well, Govnik's view and Crick's view is really an elitist view, I think, in that it's this view that ordinary people are down here on the lowlands, right? And we do not see the truth on something as important and fundamental as who are we and where did we come from. For that, we need to look up to the people in the ivory tower, the people who have, you know, climbed this mountain. They're at the top of human understanding. They're the ones who understand and see, and they declare the truth to us in the form of textbooks, and we lap it up so that we can be smart like them. Now, on the other hand, if the four-year-olds are correct, the correct picture is more like this, okay? That the academy has dug itself into a hole, and in order to become a part of the academy, you have to join them in the hole. And it's not easy to see from a hole. All you see is the dirt around you. Everyone else sees just fine, naturally. So the four-year-olds, they see on these... I'm not saying that a four-year-old understands quantum physics. I'm saying on something more important than quantum physics, which is where did we come from, we naturally see the truth just fine. And it's only by joining the academy or following that we put ourselves in the hole and we no longer see well. Well, if that is the true picture, and I claim that it is, it reminds me of a certain children's story about a naked emperor, right? Because the more you're concerned about how you're perceived, the more you're concerned about status, about what the big people think of you, the more you're going to follow and give lip service to their version of the story, no matter how silly it is. But someone who's innocent, like a child, and doesn't really care about status, and just calls a spade, you know, and says, that guy's naked, okay? That person sees the truth and is not bound to a lie just because they're worried about what people are going to say about them. I think this does reflect the situation in biology. So I want to start by talking about this universal design intuition and just put words to it. A simple way to articulate it would be to say, as makers of things, and we are makers of things, we're created to create, we instantly recognize things that were made, and we know these things can't be made without know-how. Okay? Another way to say this, the way I put it in the book, is tasks that we would need knowledge to accomplish can be accomplished only by someone who has that knowledge. In other words, from a very early age, we are oriented toward doing things and learning things. And part of that orientation is recognizing the things that we want to know, right? So tying your shoes, doing the things, making something in the kitchen. These are things that we see early on. We know that people do them, and we want to be able to do the things that people do. So even if we don't see people doing them, we see the things that people did, and those are the things that we want to learn how to do from an early age. Simply put, accidents can't do the work of know-how. If something looks like something that requires know-how, then it does require know-how. It didn't just happen. So here's an example. I use an origami crane as an example in the book, and I'll use it here. Imagine yourself at the tender age of 4, never having seen an origami crane or any origami before. If you walked into a room and that were on the table and there was no one in the room, you would pick it up and you would admire it, and you would know that is a piece of paper, but it's not just a piece of paper. It's a piece of paper that someone has done something clever to, right? And you'd know that even if you didn't see them folding it. And the way a child thinks is, wow, that's cool. Show me how was this done? And you might take it apart and not be able to put it back together. It's the same reasoning, I think, when the 4-year-old sees the real crane, or similar reasoning. And it's because there's a high, this thing is operating at a high, is doing something remarkable. And remarkable things are had only by someone doing something remarkable to arrange it, okay? And you'd be an ambitious 4-year-old to think, I want to make one of those. But similar reasoning. Okay? But all that is to say that we have this intuition and there's a certain way that we come to it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's correct. And this would be, a lot of people will read part of the title of my book and say, are you saying that intuition, are you making your argument based on intuition? And I'm not. I'm just saying it's really interesting that we all have it, that we all start there. And then it's certainly worth considering whether there's something under this intuition that actually can be shown to be correct. I'm not saying that all intuitions are correct. Okay, I want to go through a simple way of showing that actually these intuitions don't come out of thin air. There's something in the way of experience behind them, and I want to show you that there's something of substance there. So let's start with this intuition. Origami cranes can't happen by accident. And let's notice, first of all, that that's based on an observation, which is that origami cranes don't happen by accident, okay? One is the claim that they can't, and the other is the observation that they don't, in fact. And so what we mean by that, in a 4-year-old would just know that things like this don't pop into existence. But an adult would know. If you worked at a paper recycle facility, you might spend 30 years moving stacks of paper around with heavy equipment, and all kinds of things happen to paper on that job. It will be shredded, it will be torn, it will be wrinkled, it will be marred, it will be pulped and put into the recycle stream to be made into new paper. But in none of that will you see all of that accidental process happening to paper. You won't see an origami crane come out of that, right? If you did on the job see an origami crane, you would know what? You know that somebody folded an origami crane and put it in the recycle bin and now it made its way to the facility, right? That's the only way you would find one there. So that raises a question. If our observation is that origami cranes don't happen by accident, the question is, why don't they happen by accident? And if you've ever folded an origami crane, you know why they don't happen by accident. Usually they don't happen on purpose, even, after several attempts. There's a good 20 or so steps, even abbreviated here, because a lot of these steps are repeat this, flip it over, do it on the other side, each of which must be done quite precisely and in order for the origami crane to result at the very end. And you can imagine, maybe, if you go back to that recycle facility, a piece of paper being creased diagonally, but for it to be creased precisely diagonally can be a very rare event, maybe a 1 in a billion event. But that would be one step. For this whole thing to happen, 20 steps, all of that to happen by accident is impossible. So we immediately recognize that's not something that's going to happen by accident. So here's our deduction. For an origami crane to happen by accident would be unbelievably improbable. And I mean that literally. It's so improbable that we don't believe that it would happen. Well, let's extend that from origami cranes to make a general principle that accidents can't do the work of know-how. Okay, so this is not rocket science. This is all very commonsensical. But notice what we've done here in our progression. We've gone from an observation to posing a question to making a deduction and then extending that to a general principle, a law-like principle. What does that look like, that whole process? That looks like science to me. It's simple science. You don't need a PhD to do it. But it has the substance of science to it. Okay, again, I think most people would concede, yeah, it's based on observation, it's making a theory, a hypothesis is extending it. That's science, it's simple science. But a critic could say, okay, but you can do science and come to the wrong conclusion. That happens all the time. That's a part of science, is doing science, getting it wrong, and then someone correcting it. So is this correct science? What I want to do is take another pass at this, again, not technical, but to show you how this common sense way of knowing that things are designed can connect to something that you can actually prove that it's correct. And it's based on the notion of coincidence. And the reason coincidence really works here is because we have a very strong intuitive sense of coincidence. That when you saw the origami crane on the table, imagining yourself as a 4-year-old, you know that that's not just a coincidence that happened, but you can't do a probabilistic calculation. You just know. You have a feel. That can't happen by accident. Someone had to do it. Coincidence, though, does have a field of math attached to it, and that's called probability. Probability is the math of coincidence. So once you start to talk about coincidence, you have something that both connects to our intuition and can be made mathematically rigorous with the math of probability. So I want to refine this principle that accidents can't do the work of know-how. And we're going to think about it in terms of coincidence and our innate ability to recognize an unbelievable coincidence. So imagine you see a large pot on the stove. You lift the lid, and under the lid you see this. Okay, so maybe this will be our lunch today. Alphabet soup for lunch. Now, if you've ever looked at alphabet soup, and if you look at this picture, you could say, hey, there's letters. It's alphabet soup. There could be words by coincidence. It would be coincidence, right? Because the motion, the thermal motion of soup is not going to know how to spell things. So if it does spell things, it's just a pure coincidence. And it's not that hard to spot very short 2 or 3-letter words. And I found a few in here. You might see some others. And they're usually a little bit. Sometimes you have to squint. But there's C, right? And there's U's above C that I didn't circle. There's May. Okay, it's a little messy. The A is upside down. But the letters are there. If you want to go beyond that, does someone see like a 14-letter word there or something? No. If you want to go beyond that, it typically gets more messy. Now, I thought it said port there above May, but that's actually a D. So that one doesn't work. But here's rose, okay, but you have to, it's bent, and the S is upside down, but there's rose. I mean, you have to work with it. What do you expect from coincidence? Now, if you had lifted the lid and seen this, on the other hand, nobody believes that just happened by boiling the soup. Nobody would believe that. You know that someone with nothing better to do spent some time with a spoon and carefully arranged this and cleared away the other letters so that it just pops out and says pasta. That's even relevant to the theme. Okay, why is it that we know that is not a coincidence? That didn't happen by coincidence, and not just the boiling of soup that did that. It's because there's a clever arrangement, and accidental causes don't arrange things in a clever way. So we have a couple of refined principles here. One is that the more clever the arrangement, the more unlikely the coincidence needed for it to happen by accident. So those short words that were kind of ugly, like C and rose, we're prepared to say that that's just a coincidence because it wasn't very cleverly arranged, right? It's kind of a mess, and they're short words, and we had to kind of work for it. Second principle is, but with pasta, it was clearly cleverly arranged. Second is, it doesn't have to be very clever for us to rule coincidence out intuitively. After all, this is not a work of genius, my friends. It's just clearly beyond what will happen from boiling soup. Whereas this, on the other hand, or this, these are works of genius. So when you get to things like this, it's a no-brainer. Nobody, no sane person thinks that those things happen by coincidence or by accident. And if that's true of these human works of genius, I think it's far more true of these, which are far beyond any human work of genius. Those can't happen by coincidence. Those can't be accidents. Okay. Tell that to your biologist friend and they'll believe you. No, they'll probably come up with a whole list of reasons, of things that you did not take into account. Okay. All kinds of go read this. All kinds of technical things that you didn't take into account because you don't know evolutionary biology. What I want to give you, and I think that's really kind of in the spirit of these apologetics conferences, is to give simple tools that are really powerful, like what Frank Turek gave us. Simple tools that are very powerful. You don't have to get a PhD to use this. And this is based on coincidence. And if you get this, you'll get goosebumps. It's that powerful. Here it is. All right. When we look at something like this, we rightly attribute it. We ask, what can be the cause of something like that? Genius is the cause of something like that. In this sense, are there smart scientists, biologists who would love to be able to go in the lab and invent something like that? Sure, there's thousands of them. Can they do it? No. Are they smart? Yes. Is it lack of funding? Give them all the funding, all the time you want. No one can come up with anything remotely comparable to a living thing. So it's beyond human genius. That's irrefutable. That is beyond human genius because humans would love to do it and they can't do it. Now, the claim is, so we rightly attribute genius as a cause to such things because it's beyond human genius. The claim is that accidental causes, accidental processes that had no way to conceive an endpoint, had no idea what they were doing, just happened to do this. So that is the Darwinian explanation of life. Nobody conceived of the crane or any other living thing. Accidental, purposeless physical processes just stumbled upon it. But look at how radically different these two causes are, just for a moment. And right now, let's remain agnostic as to which is correct. Let's just notice this. They are as far removed from each other as can be. The lesser cause, accident, has nothing to do with genius. It's the opposite of genius. This is things just happening with no thought whatsoever, whereas genius is insight, brilliance being applied. They're completely separate, completely independent. So if it is true that this lesser cause did what the higher cause does, then it is only by coincidence because there's no connection. These are so disconnected that for this to act like this, has to be a coincidence because there's no genius in accident, right? These are as far separated as the East is from the West. So any claim that life is a product of accidental causes is a claim of coincidence, namely the coincidence that stupid things acted like they gave the product of brilliance, okay? That is sheer coincidence. The only way to get out of this is to reject the claim that this is an accident and to embrace the fact that, no, it looks like it's a work of genius because it is a work of genius. As long as people refuse to do that, they are ultimately explaining life as a coincidence. Now, we're not quite done yet because coincidences do happen. It's just that they happen in accordance with the mathematics of probability. But once we realize that if you claim that life is an accident, you are claiming that an accidental cause did what brilliance does, and therefore you're espousing coincidence fundamentally as your explanation of life. And once you do that, you've put yourself in the realm where we can test whether that's plausible or not, because coincidences obey the math of probability. Now, the interesting thing about this, once you're in this realm where you're claiming coincidence, you can layer all the complex explanations you want on that and make it as hard for people to follow as you want, and you probably will want to do that so that they can't argue with you, but you can't remove the coincidence. It's still a coincidence. It doesn't matter, because we didn't say anything about the details of what this swirling cloud is. All we said is, if you're claiming it's an accident and was not intelligently, life is not intelligently designed, you are fundamentally relying on a coincidence. All the complexity of evolutionary theory, it conceals the coincidence. It does not remove it. It shifts it somewhere where you can't speak the language anymore, so you can't argue with someone about their technical thing, but you don't need to. You can come back and say, I don't understand a word of what you said, but if you're saying that life happened accidentally, then you're talking about a coincidence, right? Now, let me illustrate this, with an example. And I could have brought my 10-sided die, but I didn't. So here's a picture of it instead. We could have someone, if I had this die, and we want to take the time, or we won't. Take this die, it's got 0 through 9, all 10 digits, and one faces up when you roll it, the one is up there. And they could go outside the room and they could roll this die 12 times and record on a piece of paper in order what face came up for all 12. So you get a 12-digit number at the end of that, right? How many 12-digit numbers are there? Does anyone have a guess? 10 raised to the 12th power. A trillion. There are a trillion. Who said that? There are a trillion possible outcomes, okay? Now, as long as the physical process of the rolling of the die out there in the back, the die hitting the carpet and coming up with these 12 numbers, has nothing to do with what we do in here to try to guess what came up, what they wrote on the paper back there, then for us to guess would be a coincidence, right? And what is the likelihood, if we sit in here and go, let's try to guess what the sequence of 12 numbers is, what is the likelihood, what is the probability that any guess we produce is correct? It's 1 in a trillion. Is there any way to change that? There is no way to change that. Short of cheating and someone going back there and watching, there is no way to change that. It's just the way it is. And what guarantees it is there's no connection between what we do in here, if we come up with a strategy to guess, and what happened back there. So it is pure coincidence. If we get it right, it is pure coincidence. And if you get that principle, all biology is doing, all evolutionary biology is doing, is trying to come up with a coincidence and stories to make a coincidence sound plausible, but it doesn't change the numbers at all. If someone said, well, let's just get 12 people, so we'll come up with our strategy. We'll line up 12 people. You'll guess the first digit, and then the second, and then the third, and the fourth, and we'll go down 12th on the front row here. Then it sounds like you could say, well, it's only 1 in 10 because we're each just only guessing one digit. And if 11 of them happen to get it right and you're the last one, then it's 1 in 10 to solve the problem, right? It's 1 in 10. Well, it's 1 in 10 multiplied 12 times, which is 1 in a trillion. There's no way around this. You can't cheat it. What if someone says, well, what if the first number back there when they rolled it happened to be 1, and then the next 3 were my area code for my cell phone, and then the next 7 were my cell phone number? Then that's 11 numbers that just happened to be my cell phone number, and then it's just 1 in 10. I have to just guess the last one, and that's correct, if. So what are the odds that it would match your cell phone number? 1 in 100 billion, and then you're 1 in 10, it takes you to 1 in a trillion. There's no way to cheat it. You can tell all the stories you want. There's simply no way around it. And biology basically has been 150 years of telling stories that cannot mask the fact that this is fundamentally about probability, not about stories. It's about a coincidence. So our third principle then, the first is the more clever the arrangement, the more unlikely the coincidence needed for it to happen by accident. The second is it doesn't have to be very clever for us to rule coincidence out intuitively. And the third is we can also rule it out by calculation, namely using the calculation of probability. Now, interestingly, I'm going to quote someone who, in words, has stated that 1 in a trillion is nothing. Okay, we're not talking about 1 in a trillion. We're talking about way beyond that. And I'll give you a feel for this in just a moment. I want to quote someone who confirms this, that the coincidence we're talking about in getting a living thing is far, far less likely than 1 in a trillion. And it's my friend Richard Dawkins that I'm going to quote. And this is from The Blind Watchmaker. He wrote this: however many ways there may be of being alive, it is certain that there are vastly more ways of being dead, or rather not alive. You may throw cells together at random over and over and over again for a billion years, and not once will you get a conglomeration that flies or swims or burrows or runs or does anything even badly that could remotely be construed as working to keep itself alive. He's spot on. If you just look at random arrangements, you'll never get the crane. You'll never get something sensible. And he said this. Richard Dawkins said this. He's like the priest of neo-Darwinism. Now, why did he say this? He said this because he thought there's an out clause here. There's two words that he thinks are the escape hatch from this improbability. Anyone know what the two words are? No, because he's saying in billions of years, this will not happen. So that's not the escape clause. At random. Because he wants to say that because natural selection is not random, it solves this fantastic coincidence, this fantastic improbability. Anybody see in his own words why that doesn't work? Natural selection is what happens when something does work to keep the organism alive, right? There is no natural selection until this problem has been solved. And so when he says that natural selection is the solution, he's confusing the order. You don't get natural selection until something does work to keep the organism alive. Then natural selection applies. So natural selection cannot explain how you got something that works to keep the organism alive. So a complete refutation of Dawkins right there in Dawkins' own words. There are, in the end, I'm saying there are two ways to come to the design conclusion. One of them is the way we do it naturally, and the four-year-old does it. The other is the way that if you want to spend 25 years in the lab, you can show that the four-year-old was right. And I once gave my testimony at a men's conference where I talked about spending 25 years, and I was embarking on the book project, and a guy after me gave his testimony was a former high school football coach, tobacco chewing, kind of rough on the edges guy, and he got up. I had just sat down. He got up, and he said, so life is designed, huh? And I said, yes. And he paused for a second. He said, you had to get a PhD to figure that out? I knew that since I was 4 years old. And I thought, he's absolutely right. You don't need a PhD to do this. But it's beautiful that you can do work at the most technical level, I think. And if you're honest, it only confirms what the four-year-old saw, which is this didn't happen by accident. So what connects these two in my book, if you see, these are really very similar ways of reasoning, but one can use math and the other is just you don't need the math. You don't need a PhD to figure this out. By intuition, clever arrangement means unbelievable coincidence means design. That was the origami crane or the real crane. By calculation, fantastically improbable arrangement, and by that I mean so improbable that the universe doesn't have enough opportunities to overcome the improbability, means fantastically improbable coincidence means design. And they're very similar. I use this term as the term that sort of connects the two, functional coherence. So it's the thing that we see. You don't call it functional coherence, but it's the thing you see that makes you know that this was a design thing. And it's also the thing that we can go and use to make probabilistic calculations to show that something was designed. It is the hierarchical arrangement of parts needed for anything to produce a high-level function, each part contributing in a coordinated way to the whole. Okay, that sounds, it has to sound a little bit more technical because we have to be able to launch from this to doing probabilistic calculations. We're not going to do them here, but in the book I do some very simple ones and show you that everything that looks like this, and you don't need to view it technically, but if you do, and you do probability calculations, you'll find that they're all fantastically improbable as coincidences. Okay, so your camera. I don't recommend that you do this. But if you do, you find that there are a whole bunch of parts, and they're all there for a reason. There's this hierarchical structure. You have the lens unit. You have all kinds of parts within parts, all of them there to perform the high-level function of a camera. But the four-year-old doesn't need to see all the parts, and we don't need to see all the parts to know that the camera's designed. You just see the high-level function it performs, and you know, hey, rocks don't do that. And that's got to have something complicated going on inside it. And this is true of everything. Anyone know what that is? Complicated. It's a three-speed bicycle hub. It's the hub of a three-seat, three-speed bicycle. You didn't know it was that complicated, did you? Okay. Now, if this is true of human-made things, this complexity of their structure, of their inner structure, and you don't, again, need to dissect them to know, you just look at the bicycle and know from what it does. Someone made it do that because it's doing something at a high level. The camera, someone made it do that. It's true of a text message or a tweet or a paragraph. If you write something, you're arranging things at the low level. The smallest units are the letters of the alphabet into words, into phrases, into sentences, into paragraphs. You're inventing something by using functional coherence, putting things together in a functional way. Well, if that's true of human-made things, you don't have to delve very deeply into biology to see that it's far more impressively true of life. Here are the major components of the human body with one organ not included there. Does anyone know what organ is not included? No? Yeah, skin is not. I think that would have been gross looking, so they decided not to do it. It's there. Yeah, see, yep, upper left. Heart should be there. I lost the heart now. Yeah, right there, right next to the chameleon tail. Wait, hey, what's that doing there? No. Okay, so let's look at an eye now. And if you zoom in and take any one of those parts, they're all extraordinarily complicated, and you keep zooming in, and the complexity just keeps coming. It's fantastically complex. The tissues within the eye, the cornea, the sclera, the lens, the retina, the vasculature, in order for all of those tissues to live, is a complex arrangement itself in order for the eye to do what the eye has to do. You can zoom in on any one of those tissues. The retina is composed of these rod and cone cells. You can see the rods and cones at the bottom there, the shape at the bottom. Beautiful hierarchical structures within structures in order for the human body to do what the human body needs to do. You can zoom in on any one of these cells, and you get this sort of complexity within the cell. This is sort of an artist's rendition of a generic animal cell. You don't have to, if you've taken biology, cell biology, you'll know, hey, ribosomes, hey, nucleus. You don't need to know that to look at that and just go, wow, that's complicated. There's something going on in there. And you can zoom in beyond that, down to the molecular level, and here's where our work has been on proteins, and specifically proteins that do chemistry called enzymes. This is a monster enzyme called the ribosome. It's the enzyme that reads along RNA that's been, so a gene has a sequence of A, C's, G's, and T's. It gets transcribed into an RNA, and this is the monster enzyme that then reads the instructions on the RNA and joins amino acids together to make proteins. And it itself is made of proteins and RNA. And we have been looking at, here's sort of a sample, like the box of chocolates of all the protein folds. There are thousands of them that have been discovered. There may be many thousands still to be discovered. These are chains of amino acids that fold into specific three-dimensional shapes in order to perform the cellular, subcellular functions of life. A remarkable array of different structures, and our work for decades now has been looking at how hard is it to get one of these? Can you get one by coincidence? What are the probabilities? Once we put it in the realm of coincidence, we can do the math and you can show. And it's not math just based on calculation, it's based on experiments. How hard is it for amino acid sequences to make one of these that works? We've I and my colleagues have been working on this problem for over 25 years. I'm going to talk about just one paper, and the whole stack of peer-reviewed papers has come out of this. Wikipedia does not take a high opinion of our work, but go read the work and make up your own mind. Here's a JMB article, came out in Journal of Molecular Biology in 2004, around the time that Biologic was formed, and I'm going to talk very briefly about this one because it puts a number on the coincidence. And again, so a gene, that's a little piece of DNA at the bottom. DNA, the genes on DNA carry sequence instructions in the forms of A, C's, G's, and T's that get translated through this marvelous genetic code into sequences of amino acids represented by the beads on the string of the different colors. There's 20 different amino acids, and the different colors are supposed to sort of give you an idea that you've got lots of different variety of these amino acids, and how they're strung up together is determined by the sequence of A, C's, G's, and T's in the DNA. And how they're strung together turns out to be crucial for the next step, which is these things would do no good whatsoever if they were just floppy like spaghetti in boiling water. They need to fold up into one of those structures, like the structures that I showed you. And that requires a very special arrangement of these amino acids so that they lock into a folded form. And they're not ugly like that. They're more elegant, like this, for example. The curls are alpha helices, they're called, and the arrows are beta strands. Those are the two basic units of local structure. It's called secondary structure. This is a single protein chain that has the special properties to fold into this special shape, and this is an enzyme called beta-lactamase. If you're a bacterial cell trying to infect humans, this is a wonderful enzyme. If you're a human trying not to be infected by bacterial cells, it's an awful enzyme. This is the enzyme that makes penicillin so ineffective in clinical settings. It was the spread of... So penicillin was initially very effective when it was first used. And over decades of use, the gene for this enzyme got spread so widely among bacteria that now penicillin enzymes are not as effective because so many of them get destroyed by this enzyme. That's green. The green molecule up there is penicillin. This enzyme binds it very quickly, breaks it, and then gets the next penicillin molecule. So it allows bacteria to survive in the presence of penicillin. It was a good test case for us to look at how specific the sequence has to be in order for this to fold, because we could mess it up and then put the messed up genes in bacteria, put them on petri dishes with penicillin, and if it didn't work, then no colony would grow. But if it did work, if this still worked, then they'd form a colony. And so you could very quickly find out, okay, we made a million messed up versions of this. How many of them work? It's very easy to test. So that was the basis of this JMB paper. What I did is look at the simplicity of this. This is really artificially simple to help you see what the shape of the protein is. You really have this complex molecule where it's all these side chains, these appendages that distinguish the different 20 amino acids, are what interlock and allow this thing to fold. And so the whole experiment was, if we randomize these, will they still interlock and fold? And, well, the bacteria will tell us. If they grow and form a colony, then it did fold. If they don't, then it didn't. I want to show you briefly here, using an illustration. That paper came up with a number. The question that was being asked is, how common are the sequences that do fold among the whole set of possible sequences? And you can think of that as a, if you want to think of it evolutionarily, there's a search through this whole space of possibilities that has to be performed, and it has to succeed by accident if evolution is true. And I wanted to show in the paper how small is the target, how impressive is that search that would have to happen by coincidence, that you'd have to hit a small target in order for the enzyme to form. And I wanted to give us a sort of illustration of that by doing a little search illustration. I need a volunteer for this. It will be only mildly painful. No, it won't. It won't be at all painful. You can do it. You can. It's just pointing a laser, right? Do you want to do it? Anybody? Anybody? Yeah, okay, come on up. All right. Here's the way it works. Everyone give a big hand to our... Okay, so you get the green laser. Let me see if it works. So that button, if you'll have to hold it in.
Okay.
It's that button. Okay, but what I'm going to do before you do that, and don't aim low, because you're going to close your eyes.
Okay.
Did I tell you about that? No. Okay, I'm going to put the target, which is going to be this red dot, and it's a black ceiling, so it's really going to be... You won't need to see it because you're going to be blindfolded, because this is just coincidence, right? This is not you trying to hit it. This is it just being hit. I can't see because I got the lights in my... Where is the red dot? Oh, there. Okay. So what I can do is I can use my... No, that isn't it. It's over here. Man, this is really tricky. Yeah. So I should be able to set this little thing. Okay. So you need to not look. Close your eyes. And what I'm going to do is when I have put the red dot up there somewhere, you can keep your eyes closed and you just kind of wander around with your green dot and maybe you'll hit it. You never know. Stranger things happen. Okay, close your eyes. I really can't see where it's going here. No, I don't want any voices help. Okay, I'm not moving it. Okay, you can go, but don't go too low because I don't want to burn anyone's retina out. Okay, search. Search. Actually, she came really pretty close. Usually, you don't come anywhere near it. A big applause for our coincidental searcher. Now, okay, so she refuted this by actually succeeding. What makes that hard geometrically? It's the relative size of the pinpoint of the beams of light and what? The ceiling, in this case, which is the search space. And I'm going to show you what the equivalent of this would be for searching to get a single protein like the one that I studied. It's actually harder than this. It's actually harder than the search that she virtually solved in front of our eyes. So let's imagine making it harder. We decided that it's the relative size of the laser beam. So let's take pinpoint size laser beam and let's do a different ceiling. This building is not big enough. We're going to take the largest building in the world in terms of volume, which is north of Seattle. It's the Boeing. It's where they make the Boeing jets, the big assembly fabrication plant. The largest building in the world in terms of volume, which means I think that's probably the largest ceiling in the world, I'm guessing. Anyway, it's pretty big. And if we clear out all the equipment and we had one laser pin-sized laser dot on there and someone else blindfolded were to wander around, that's the equivalent of a random, unguided search. It's only by coincidence that the two beams would converge, pinpoint on pinpoint. You can imagine you could probably spend a good chunk of your life doing that before, and you could get very close, but oh, not quite, and now you're a long way away. That's not as hard... Not nearly as hard as the search that we're talking about in finding one functional protein. To give you an idea of the actual hardness of the protein search, it would be more like laser beams that are the size of a hydrogen atom, and that's a very fine laser beam. And the ceiling we would be looking at would be the backdrop of the visible universe. Okay? So... That's not going to happen. Billions of years don't really matter when you're talking about something that's that fantastically improbable. And that's one protein. A bacterial cell needs about 1,000 of these. We need tens of thousands. And different creatures use different ones. So, and that's just the proteins. That's not the rest. When you get numbers like this, this is why it becomes rigorous. It's not just that we're saying that all accidental explanations of life have to ultimately appeal to coincidence. We're saying that once you recognize that, you can put a number on the coincidence and you can show that it's impossible. Game over. And you can't fix it by going and making your evolutionary theory more complicated. Remember? The only way you can fix the problem is by saying, oh, you're right. It's not an accident. Life is designed. It all boils down to this. Stumbling upon clever things by accident is impossible because it would require an impossibly improbable coincidence. And here's the bottom line. These things look like the work of genius because they are the only way to get rid of this impossible the problem of claiming an impossible coincidence is to get rid of the claim that it happened by accident. That's the only solution. That is the end of my talk. I would love to take questions about anything. And do we do a microphone for questions, or are we recording the questions? Or okay, I'll repeat them. Yeah, and I'll try to do your voice as well as I can. No. Yes, we had one over here. Okay. Okay, so did everyone, should I repeat all the, okay, so the question was, given sort of the rigor, the mathematical rigor of doing these calculations, has that changed the mind of the academic journals so that now they see, okay, you're doing real science here and we'll publish this stuff now? Well, that JMB paper, which came up with a number of 1 in 10 to the 77th power, 1 in a trillion, 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 did go through rigorous peer review and was published in JMB, which is an academic journal. Since then, it's only gotten worse. And that paper has been cited for this reason lots and lots of times. And since publishing that, I've had one other paper published in mainstream academic journals, and then I've been blacklisted. So the politics of, they don't want to hear it. It may not, it could be this. If you're the editor of a journal, you may not be involved in this debate. You may not be for or against Darwinism. You're sort of a lukewarm Darwinist. You don't really care about this. But what you do care about is people shrieking about your journal publishing a paper that was written by someone who's labeled as a creationist, okay, someone who's not a Darwinist. Because people pounce on your journal. People have unpublished, this is unheard of, I never heard of it in the history of science until recently, they have unpublished papers for this reason, because the editors get so, they get so attacked, and it becomes a question of, am I going to let my journal sink because we published this paper or not? And so they unpublish it and apologize, a retraction and an apology. So it has gotten far worse. The situation is one where the stronger the argument against Darwinism, the more vitriolic the defense, I'm afraid. So let's go to the back here and then we'll... Yeah. It's actually not an argument from ignorance. And in fact, if we saw the origami crane and we didn't know who folded it, we would still be right in saying someone folded it. And so did you see the movie Contact, by any chance, way back with Jodie Foster in it? There's a case where there's something remarkable that comes, that's decoded from this. It's basically an extraterrestrial intelligence movie. It's based on Sagan's work, and the signal that comes from a faraway planet is decoded, and it has complex instructions for building a machine, and they didn't even know what the machine does, but it's clearly blueprints for making a machine. Okay, so in that case, there's not even a question in the movie of whether the signal had an intelligent source or not. It's not even, no one would think that that didn't have an intelligent source. But you don't know who the source is, and you don't even know what the machine is, and you can't show, you can't go find the people who gave the source. There's not even a question of it. So this is not actually, what I gave is an argument that is at no point that I say, because we don't know anything, I'm going to say there's an intelligent source. I'm saying we do know something. We know that this is a coincidence if it's not an intelligent source, and we know that the math of coincidence is probability. So we do the math. It didn't happen by accident. It has an intelligent source. That's not, so I am not arguing, it is not a God of the gaps argument. It is a math argument, okay? You don't need to know who, and if you agree or not, I'd love to talk with you later, but this is not a gaps argument. It's not based on ignorance. What slide did I appeal to ignorance? There is no slide that appeals to ignorance. The fact is, it's a false premise to say you have to know who the intelligence was to rightly infer that there was an intelligence. You don't. That's false. You do not need to know that. And I just proved it. Okay. Yes. I'm saying if you take that, remember that Dawkins quote about you can throw these things together for billions of years and not once will you get a conglomeration that even remotely flies or swims or burrows or does anything remotely helpful. I'm saying that number, if you take the fraction of possible physical configurations that would be a complex life form, that is the target that has to be hit. And if that's hit by chance that had no ability to see that target or conceive it, then you're ultimately making an argument of coincidence that whatever layers you put on it, you're talking about something that had no ability to see where it was going there. Okay? No, you've not changed that number at all. All you've done is made it so that fewer and fewer people know what you're talking about. You haven't changed the number at all. Okay, in the back over here. Yes. Do you want me to go back to it? I'm not sure I can. Okay, so I read the book, and I read this. I've read it several times. I don't want to, he could be here and he could answer for himself, but, and I'll try to do this. I'm trying to give you his words the way I think he would say it. He thinks, the book is called The Blind Watchmaker, and he thinks natural selection is the blind watchmaker. So he thinks that, although it's perfectly right for us to look at living things and think, whoa, that's a work of genius, he thinks natural selection is the genius. It's not a personal genius. It has no ability to plan what it's going to do, but it ends up doing brilliant things. And he ends up using what I call in the book, and I didn't go into this in detail, a stepping stone argument. So Darwin himself claimed, he wrote about the eye and said the eye is a marvelous device and it seems like it calls into question my whole theory. But we can look at these simpler eyes. You look at the octopus eye. You look at all these things all the way down to something that could be a light-sensitive spot. And Dawkins repeats this argument and fleshes it out with a little more detail, saying you don't have to have the full-on camera lens eye like we have. There are things that are light-sensitive that don't have an eye. But all he's really done, he's laid out stepping stones as though they solve this problem, and they don't. Because if you grant a bacterial cell that has that responds to light and uses chemotaxis or something that goes toward the light, like cyanobacteria are light responsive. They form these mats that will sense the direction of the sun and move the whole mat in the direction of the sun in order to get more light because they're doing photosynthesis. That doesn't give you any step toward a compound eye in an insect, a complex eye in a vertebrate. So all he does is assumes that because there are things that are simpler that could be of value, that somehow solves the problem of getting the more complex thing that is of value, and it doesn't. You still have to solve. If I give you cyanobacteria, then we say, what would have to happen to get an insect? You're back to this enormous coincidence that's not solved. So what's really happening is our intelligence can string together something and then try to turn it into a plausible story. But that's only because we can look at it, we can arrange these things and say, hey, look at this. There could be something that happens. And what happens is you're really masking the coincidence in the story. You're giving a range of 15 things that have eyes that are simpler than our eyes and pretending that that tells you a whole process where our eyes come from. But if you tease apart that story and say, okay, show me the next step, it's not there. There is no next step. Okay? So it's really disguising. He's doing the shell game, but he doesn't see it that way. I'm not claiming that there's anything duplicitous, or I think he believes what he's saying. It's just you get yourself tied up in your own way of viewing things. Do we have a hard break at right now? Like, because say it again. Okay, we have other people coming in at 11, so we need to transition. I can take one or two more, and then after this, I will be signing books. Not just mine, I will sign anyone's books at the discovery table. Front row. Oh, yeah, go to the bookstore, get my book. Undeniable, yeah. It's undeniably at the bookstore. Okay. Any arrangement is equally improbable. Right.